This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Today, we're in La Pierre Saint-Martin.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freep.
Hello, Lionel Richie.
Oh, I haven't done that for a while, have we? Nice, like it. Hello, Lionel. Where are we?
We are at the top of the climb, La Pierre Saint-Martin, the conclusion of stage 10 of the Tour de France, outside our luxurious press tent, overlooking the... It was great because we could see the race come up just below us there. We had a good view over the road. Quite nice to be up here in the Pyrenees.
Before we sum up today's action, we were at the start this morning, Lionel, start of the first mountain stage of the Tour, the day after the rest day. Always a difficult proposition for riders, especially a stage like today where the big climb came right at the end. But can you set the scene this morning? You spoke to a few people.
Yeah, it was hot and sunny in Tarbes this morning. I spoke to Max Chiandri, sports director with BMC Racing. He was delighted about TJ Van Garderen's opening 9 days and the position that they were in this morning. Less delighted about the fact that the BMC's planned rest day barbecue didn't happen because they couldn't get the barbecue to work. So they just had an ordinary meal. But so he said team spirit was excellent and they were really looking forward to keeping TJ Van Garderen well in contention at the end of the first Pyrenean mountain stage. And then I also spoke to Sean Yates, sports director with Tinkoff Saxo, and I asked him whether Tinkoff's tactics would be to attack, and he said they would just wait and see. So this is Max Chiandri and Sean Yates talking about their chances for the first Pyrenean stage.
Yeah. What you'd say is important on the rest day, just to do something for your own mental well-being, physical well-being?
Yeah, you know, it's a super deserved rest day. I think riders were really tired. Pushing the TT at day 9 was pretty... It's a hard push, you know. It's a big... I was just talking to one guy. He said, it's pretty short, the TT, but it's a massive effort, you know. It's a massive team effort by the riders and by the staff, you know, just pulling it all together and making it happen. So usually we have a barbecue, but we... Our barbecue broke.
So, oh no! What went wrong?
I don't know. He wouldn't stand up, and we couldn't use it in the hotel because we didn't have the space, and so we just had a get together, a little drink, and you know, a little celebration from the day before. I think rider wise, it's a coffee stop in the morning, so they like to just go out, start for a coffee. Some of them do a little bit of an effort, maybe just to kind of you know, activate fibers, stuff like that, and sleep in the afternoon, you know, just take the best of it.
So the first 9 days, I guess, couldn't have gone any better, but now the real tough stuff starts.
Well, you know, we divided the tour in two stages, in two big sections, I'd say, or whatever you want to call them. So one was finishing with the TTT, you know, so we brought adequate guys to really keep TJ safe and in front, and mission accomplished on that side. You know, on that we added on a yellow jersey and a victory, and a team time trial victory, so that's fantastic for us. Second part, we got our riders for the second part to be around TJ, and from day on now, from this day, it's going to be... Yeah, as you said, a different tour. It's a totally different Tour de France. We're going to approach things a little bit in the same way. You know, we just like to keep TJ in front, out of danger, even on the early part of the stage where there's a few categorized four smaller climbs, but just to be safe side. And then, you know, then it comes up. And on these finishes, on these uphill finishes, and this one, Andouez or whatever, it's up to the GC contenders, you know. It's their Tour de France, you know, so I think TJ is good. He's good, he's healthy, he's focused, great morale, you know. Coming out of Dauphiné, I think he had a fantastic morale and a better belief in success, you know, so he's doing good, and we'll see today.
What's the plan for Tinkoff Saxo today? Will it be attack, attack, attack?
I think the plan is to follow and see. See who's gonna, you know, do what, and maybe other teams have obviously got the same idea, because the first mountain stage is always a bit, you know, possibly, but as I said before, in the old days, you know, injury, first mountain stage, you just smash it, try and get an advantage and just consolidate for the rest of the race. So, I mean, we've got to expect every scenario, but it's not our plan to go out and you know, I mean, the fact that it's one climb is not ideal for Alberto. You know, we're waiting for the harder days or more mountains. But this, having said that, this mountain is pretty damn hard.
Yeah, the Col de Soudet is one of the hard ones, isn't it? And it, I suppose it's a change of rhythm as well, is it, from the flatlands and then just the one climb, as you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's 2 weeks ago since we left for the start of the Tour de France, and since then we've done nothing but, you know, apart from the little exceptions like the Mur de Huy and Mur de Bretagne, it's all been small wing stuff, you know, so suddenly you're going to go hitting 10, 13% climb in this heat. Obviously it's been quite hot until now, but it's not the same really, so it's going to be a bit of a shock to the system for a few. Obviously some guys rock up and they feel super duper on that first day, others may take a bit of a bracket, so no one really knows where they are, so they're probably thinking, okay, we'll see how it goes, and obviously if they feel good, and then they're going to take advantage, or try to take advantage. And I think guys like Kitano, you know, who are used to the hot weather, are super climbers, and obviously got to get time back, might have a dig today. It's Bastille Day, so, you know, Thibaut Pinot has lost a lot of time. He won a stage like this in Tour Switzerland, you know, not long ago, just one climb in the day, and he, you know, climbed very well, so... Obviously, if he were to win today, he'd be a superhero, I think. So, you know, obviously those guys, their GC's done for them, pretty much, so they need to concentrate on stages. And AG2R won my stage. There's always a bit of rivalry. And when you think their possibilities, they're not going to win in a bunch kick. There's only a few couple of days when a breakaway is going to stick. So, you know, if I were them, I'd try and control it so it comes down.
Okay, we heard there from Max Chiandri and Sean Yates. That was before today's stage, and we'll talk about today's stage in a minute, but we had a rest day yesterday. There is a lot to talk about today, not only the result, but some of the fallout from various events and things and assumptions and all the rest of it. But we had a rest day yesterday. It was eventful, as all these days always are in Po. And Daniel, you were at the Tinkoff Saxo press conference where Ivan Basso announced the very sad news that he has testicular cancer and had to leave the race.
Yeah, I was there waiting for the press conference, what we imagined would be a fairly routine press conference with Alberto Contador. I was waiting with Ciro, actually, our good friend Ciro Scognamiglia, and Ciro got a message on his phone a couple of minutes before the press conference was about to start. He said it was something serious, but he didn't know exactly what it was yet, and we went into the press conference. Basso started to talk about health problems, and I anticipated that an injury had flared up at some point during the tour and he might use this opportunity to announce that he was retiring from the race and possibly also from professional cycling. But no, it wasn't that. I think everyone knows now that Basso announced he had testicular cancer, and very moving scenes, really. Alberto Contador was very, very emotional next to him. They've spent 120 of the last 180 days together, Alberto Contador and Ivan Basso, with training and high-altitude camps in Tenerife. And, you know, 5 or 10 minutes later, Ivan Basso was getting into a car with Giovanni Lombardi, his agent and friend, and they were leaving for Toulouse Airport and they flew back to Milan. I mean, I just wanted to say, really, that, you know, I've known Basso for an awfully long time, about 10 or 12 years, I think, when I first interviewed him. Had a very good relationship with him, not agreed with certain moral choices he's made, never really believed his version of events in 2006, and I think he knows that I don't believe, and a lot of other journalists don't believe in that. But you kind of distinguish between, or you make the distinction between the professional relationship that you have and how you may feel about certain things that someone's done in their professional life, and how he has been and how he is consistently on a personal level. And just to say that he's an incredibly affable guy, very, very polite, really makes a great effort to say hello. He'll, you know, we made a joke about it the other day when we gave him the Pedalo de Charme jersey. He sort of fought his way through a crowd just to say hello. Very curious, he asked questions, which is rare for a rider, an athlete, to a journalist. So just to say really that we wish him all the very best and hope to see him back on a bike in not too long.
Okay, so on to the race. We played, heard it earlier on from Sean Yates. Max Chandri, obviously very optimistic, as everybody is going into the first mountain stage when everything's very close. It's where the mountains are really reveal form. They're unsparing in revealing exactly how people are going. Everything before then is a prelude, is a bit of guesswork. You know, you try to work out how Chris Froome is going, from how he handles himself in the cobbles and the crosswinds on the small climbs. But it's these mountain stages where the truth is revealed. And on the climb up to the finish, the truth of this year's race was revealed. Vincenzo Nibali was the first man out at the back. Alberto Contador, they were falling, you know, all over the place. Romain Bardet, Jean-Christophe Perrault, Thibaut Pinot, they were falling out the back like the trapdoor had been opened.
Yeah, they were, and I mean, it was a massacre really on the mountain. I would say Max and Sean were cautiously optimistic, waiting to see how it would go. I also spoke to Dave Brailsford briefly, and he was saying that Sky would ride a conservative, defensive race today. And I wasn't sure whether I necessarily believed that, but I could see that in certain circumstances they might just sort of tick the first mountain stage off without taking any risks. They don't really need to do anything. But as Chris Froome said in his post-race press conference, once they smelled blood, they really went for it. And the time gaps were, in the scheme of things, in the overall Tour de France, were huge. I mean, Nairo Quintana a minute back, Alberto Contador 2:51, and Vincenzo Nibali 4:25. I mean, you know, these are sort of, certainly in Nibali's case, kind of Tour ambition ending deficits.
Yeah, you know, Froome can't help himself. I don't think, if he was instructed to ride defensively, I just don't think he would. If he feels good, if he feels like attacking, even sometimes when he doesn't feel good, he will attack. It's what he likes to do, and he won alone in the yellow jersey. To see that, such a decisive move so early in the race, I think was quite dispiriting for a lot of people. And there was a very flat sort of atmosphere in the press room and even at the finish. You know, there's still so many tough stages to come. The one thing I will say is that although Quintana didn't put up much of a fight today, he is a bit of a grinder. We've seen him get better as Grand Tours go. We saw that in the Giro last year. We saw that in the Tour in 2013. Had the Tour in 2013 been 4 weeks long, he probably would have won it the way things seem to be going. So I wouldn't discount him yet. I think, you know, and Valverde's obviously going pretty well, his Movistar teammate. Some music coming from up there. So I wouldn't discount Quintana. I don't think that, you know, I don't think he's over. I think this, and you've talked about this, Daniel, this, the shock to the system of this first mountain stage, it catches a lot of people out.
I think it does, particularly with a stage like today's. It reminded me very much of the 2004 stage to La Mongie. Very, very similar in the sense that it was quite a straightforward stage to the foot of the climb. And what that means is that no one really holds anything back. No one is intimidated. No one is frightened about the mountain that's coming. If anything, a lot of the climbers in the peloton can't wait to get to the foot of that first mountain. But I think what happens is a lot of them burn too many matches and they get almost overexcited, overeager. And we do often see a lot of damage. I mean, that stage in 2004 caused a huge amount of damage, and it was very, very similar today. And Quintana, it wasn't a stage that suited Quintana. I thought the climb might have suited him quite well because it was very sort of staccato, the rhythm. It was a lot of very steep ramps followed by false flats, which might in theory have suited him. But I actually thought he held on pretty well today. And when we get to the stages with multiple big climbs, particularly the sort of 2,000 meter climbs, I think he will fare better. And the Movistar performance was a pretty good one, not obviously as strong as Team Sky. Geraint Thomas was incredibly strong. Walt Powell, who I thought would go well today because this is the kind of climb that suits him, he did. And then Richie Porte, who delivered a performance that was very similar to the performance at Axe Trois Domaines 2 years ago, and the way he reacted after Chris Froome had gone down the road was very similar as well, in the sense that Richie Porte carried on racing, looked almost as though he wanted to, well, finish second on the stage and move up general classification. And Sky were pretty aggrieved at that a couple of years ago, because they felt he used up vital energy. And we know what happened the next day after that stage in Axe-Trois-Domaines. Sky sort of blew apart and exploded, including Richie Porte. So it'll be interesting to see what happens tomorrow.
Well, on that stage, of course, Movistar and Tinkoff Saxo, Movistar in particular, went on the rampage. Well, Garmin started it, actually. They went on the rampage early on, but then it produced splits. Peter Kennick disappeared down a ravine. Richie Porte kind of blew up, and Froome was left very isolated, and his rivals probably didn't take enough of advantage of that as they should have done. But Froome then, and it looks like now, is on a different level. I mean, he just looks like the best guy in the race.
Oh, without question. I mean, yeah, the way that he rode today, the gaps he's got, he now doesn't have to do what he did today, and you know, he can ride that defensive race. Sky can ride the defensive race in with such an advantage. They don't need to go and do that, and it will be interesting to see whether they just conserve for a couple of days, the remaining 2 days in the Pyrenees, and then, you know, maybe make another statement in the Alps, or whether, you know, whether they seek to just absolutely hammer home the advantage they've got while it's so apparent that Chris Froome is this strong.
Well, Richie Porte is an interesting one, isn't he? Because he had certainly had personal ambitions in 2013. He wanted to finish on the podium. He wanted to do the 1-2, as Team Sky had done in 2012 with Wiggins and Froome. He wanted to repeat that in 2013, seeing what had happened to Froome. And we know that Richie Porte is leaving Team Sky. We're pretty sure he's signed for BMC, pretty sure of that. So that's an interesting scenario. A rider who's definitely leaving, he did confirm that on the rest day. You know, and he was second on the stage. He's not that high up overall. I'm searching for him because he did lose quite a bit of time in the first. He's well down overall, so his overall ambitions are gone. But you know, you would think he would want to win one of these stages, wouldn't you?
You would. But are we going to talk about the social media storm?
Of course we are, Daniel. Yeah, well, it links to Froome's dominance, but also his team's. I mean, Geraint Thomas finishing fifth on the stage, that is a breakout performance for him on a mountain stage. And Richie Porte, obviously, second on the stage. Sorry, I'm looking at the general classification. Geraint Thomas was sixth on the stage with Alejandro Valverde. Outstanding team collective performance, which coupled with a story that broke on Monday night, on the rest day night, where a video was released of Froome's performance on Mont Ventoux in 2013 with an analysis of his power output and heartbeat at regular intervals up the climb. Now Dave Brailsford, Team Sky, had spoken to some British journalists earlier on Monday, before this stuff was released, and said that he thought they'd been the victims of hacking, which suggests that he knew that this was about to be released, this material. We managed to have a quick look at it before it was swiftly taken down off the internet. It's funny, I mean, the way the news cycle works is that those British journalists were told the story at about 11 o'clock in the morning, then they sat on it all day for it to go in the next day's papers, so it was released at 11 p.m. at night. It wasn't, which was just after it had been released on YouTube. So it looked as though Brailsford talking about hacking and threatening legal action was a response to the material being released. Now, he may well have known the material was going to be released, but it's important to state that that wasn't a reaction to it actually being released. However, if that makes sense. We had a look at the video footage. What did you... Well, none of us are scientists, but we've obviously reasonably familiar with power outputs and heart rates, although that's very much 20 years ago sort of sports science, isn't it? The focus on heart rates. But anyway, Daniel, what did you make of it?
Well, the first thing I think we should specify is that the video had not been released, but it was known that someone had obtained this information, or certainly claimed to have obtained Chris Froome's actual power file, not a power estimate, but his actual power numbers from the 2013 stage up the Mont Ventoux. I mean, rather than talk about the what it tells us, this power data, I think we should comment briefly on that sort of PR move that Sky have made, and by trying to get on the front foot. Dave Brailsford coming forward and saying that they were thinking about taking legal action, or they had taken legal action because they thought that the data had been hacked. I mean, I just question the wisdom of that decision, really. I mean, I don't have all the facts. I don't know exactly why he did that. It looked slightly to me like a bit of a choreographed story, the way that it was put out by Team Sky. British journalists after a press conference. No one else seemed to have the story. It was only four British journalists. They all released the story, or published the story at the same time. And, you know, I just think that it really poured fuel on the flames of what was a story that really was no different from what has been said for the last 2 years. There is a huge body of people on social media and who use other channels who believe that Chris Froome is doped, let's face it, and they've used power numbers to back up this thesis, and it was just more of the same. And Sky, I think, have addressed this in the past. I know Chris Froome is taking active steps personally. He's thinking about this, ways to address this after the Tour de France. That hasn't happened yet, but I just don't understand why Dave Brailsford has released or has talked about the fact they want to take legal action, and, you know, made it a bigger story than it needs to be. I think, as Muhammad Ali, the great Muhammad Ali, once said, silence is golden when you don't have a good answer.
During the Tour de France, listen twice a day to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. There is all the latest interviews and analysis from every stage in the evening show. And in the morning, Monday to Friday, Kilometer Zero will take you inside the Tour in the company of the podcast team, Richard Moore, Daniel Fripp and Lionel Burney.
As for the leaked power file, or the hacked power file, and the video that it's been overlaid on, showing watts and heart rate, until somebody can actually come forward and say this is humanly impossible, we have no real story here. I mean, you can't take some of those data points and say, well, that's abnormal. I mean, what is abnormal in the context of accelerating on a mountain? We don't know. Is there a handbook that tells us exactly what is impossible, clean, and what isn't? And I think that we're getting into a real difficult and dangerous areas here, where any kind of evidence will just be used to put forward a case for the prosecution or a case for the defence.
The problem as well is that where we are at in cycling is a reluctance or a refusal to accept exceptional performances. And human beings in any field, and I've said this before, are capable of exceptional performances. I mean, of course Chris Froome's numbers on Mont Ventoux look abnormal. Of course they look extraordinary. He is an extraordinary athlete. The whole point of the Tour de France is that extraordinary athletes take part in it. That's why only four guys at the start of the race could win it, out of all the professionals in the world.
Yeah, we're getting to a point where the kind of the physical freaks, which is what they are really, and the outliers, what should we do? What, basically bar them from taking part because they don't fit within the normal range? I mean,
We don't know if Chris Froome is clean or dirty. We don't know. We can only go by our own gut feel and the questions that we've asked him, how well we think we know him and Dave Brailsford from Team Sky. But unless you are him, unless you live with him, you cannot know. But what I do know is that a lot of people who assert that he is cheating don't know either. I think that the questions are absolutely legitimate, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with being suspicious of these performances, because we were duped with Armstrong and with others. So there's nothing wrong with that at all. However, there are people in what I would call quite privileged positions, journalists and people who in the past have said, well, you know, I knew that something was going, I couldn't say it because blah, blah, blah. Those people have to be really careful and really responsible about what they do say now, because I think there's always an assumption that they know more than they're able to say. I don't know more than I'm able to say on this. I can only go by how well I think I know Team Sky and the setup. I do know that back in 2007, when I spoke to Dave Brailsford about the subject of doping for the first time, when he was performance director at British Cycling, I do know that then he gave me what I felt was the best, most persuasive sort of anti-doping argument when he explained his philosophy that I'd ever heard. And it was based a lot on his experiences with David Miller and with how he'd been running the British cycling team.
Yeah, just to go into some detail about the figures themselves, there's a moment in particular on the Ventoux when Froome attacks and he sort of goes over 600 watts for about 40 seconds. Just to put that in perspective, Vincenzo Nibali the other day on the Mur de Bretagne, when he really struggled, and at one point he was caught, he was kind of boxed in and he had to do a significant effort to get back within the vicinity of the front group. I think he did 533 watts, Paolo Slongo's coach at Astana told us. For over 2 minutes, he sustained that. So that gives you some perspective on what it
that's
is.
That's an out of form.
Yeah, maybe. And that's an out. That's a Vincenzo Nibali who's really, really struggling in this Tour de France. And I think when you talk about Froome being absolutely extraordinary or extraterrestrial, I think the most important statistic is to look at the actual results of that stage and look how much he won by. Over a climb at the Ventoux takes about an hour, and I think he won, well, the majority of his closest rivals that day were within a couple of minutes or so. I'd have to check that, but and we see that time and time again, and today he won by a minute. It's really not that extraordinary in the history of the Tour de France to see someone win a mountain stage by a minute. So, but you know, from a physiological point of view, looking at that video that was posted today, I think it's gone back up. I think for physiologists, there's a guy who posts on Twitter at Velo Clinic, his handle is, who was gave a very rational analysis of what he saw today. But I think from a physiological point of view, it is interesting because there are some interesting things going on there. But ultimately, it's not going to tell us whether Chris Froome dopes or not.
Yeah, I just want to clarify, you know, when I said I've called it a massacre and a murder on the road, I mean, probably inappropriate.
But it's funny, I mean, we're at a sorry pass, aren't we?
In a sporting sense, you know, this is like sort of 6-1, 6-1 in tennis, really. You know, that's a... Yeah.
And that can happen in a Grand Slam final.
Of course it can, absolutely. Yeah. So we've got to be really careful in how we talk about the race. You've got to kind of... You know, you've got to be able to sort of talk about the sort of sporting performance and say, you know, an extraordinary sporting performance without that being seen as sort of shorthand. And like you're saying, Richard, oh, he's trying to say something, you know, obliquely.
And now, le pédaleur de charme, supported by British Eurosport.
Okay, from the ridiculous to the sublime, today's British Eurosport Pedaler de Charme. We actually had a productive morning this morning, Lionel, didn't we? We managed to get rid of a couple of T-shirts. André Greipel looked absolutely thrilled with his.
He did. No, he didn't. He didn't.
He,
didn't.
He was smiling inside.
He was smiling inside. I think once I'd explained again what the great honour that was being bestowed on him, you know, I can see that... that T-shirt being sort of scrunched up in his garage to wash his bikes with.
That's going to be in the Greipel Hall of Fame. And Brian Cockar, the friend of the podcast, was very pleased with his and actually got a photo of himself on the bus wearing it.
He is the Eugène Christophe of the Pedaleur de Charme jersey. He's the first one to actually put it on.
And of course we make a Brian Cockar T-shirt. What an oversight not to bring one and present Brian with it.
That was a massive oversight. Let's do today's Pedaleur de Charme. We'll make it brief. Lot of nominations for Geraint Thomas. Who
he gets a lot of nominations every day, isn't it? It's a bit like, you know, the Tour de France still runs a fan mail service. Mm. And every single year, Rui Costa wins by about 1,000 letters or messages.
It used to be Richard Varonc, didn't it? And in the old days, it was Charlie Gall.
But there is something odd. That is pas normal, the way Rui Costa wins every year. There is something.
Do you think he's fan mail doping?
I think he definitely is.
I think he's sending his family and friends.
He's either sending himself fan mail or it's Pippo Pozzato.
You've still owe us a Pippo Pozzato feature.
Pippo, we had a long chat yesterday. Ciro, Pippo and I.
Okay, Geraint Thomas.
Save it.
Geraint Thomas, Pedaleur de Charme. We'll try and get him a T-shirt tomorrow. Just final on the we were talking about doping suspicion. We'll no doubt return to that. We also have our perk should be released early next week, and we'll hopefully deal with everything in there. We've got some interviews with some interesting people, including Antoine Veyer,
yes.
Daniel, who has been one of Froome's sternest critics. So that should be going up next week. Look out for that. But we will be returning to that topic.
Yeah, we were. Let's crack on with the race, shall we? Talk about everybody else.
Well, defending champion. Go on.
Well, let's just run through the damage that was done, really. It's Bastille Day. The French had a very hot and cold day. Thibaut Pinot and Romain Bardet were among the first big casualties on the final climb. Andrew Talansky and Dan Martin got dropped together at the same time for Cannondale Garmin.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, Vincenzo Nibali was in the Rigoberto Uran group. Uran making an unconventional bid to become a member of the Fab Four by joining up with Nibali. Unfortunately, they were both going backwards at the time. Alberto Contador was next to go. He really went after Valverde. Alejandro Valverde put the pressure on at the front. And at that point, I thought Nairo Quintana might use that as a springboard, but he didn't. He sat tight. Then TJ Van Garderen drifted off the back. And then finally, 6.3 kilometres to go, Chris Froome made that final move. And Quintana was also distanced. I mean, that's a kind of the shorthand summary of the day. All the big names in the Tour de France suffered.
Wow. And Nibali, the defending champion, really is sinking down the general classification by the day, isn't he? He looked very pale, he looked very wan at the finish line this evening. He seems to think it's a physical problem. He was just out of breath from the start as soon as they hit the climb today. A lot of the Astana management, and Giuseppe Martinelli, the direct sportif, Paolo Slongo, Nibali's coach, seemed to think that his head has gone slightly, and did quite early in the race when he lost time on the second stage in Holland. His morale certainly took a big blow there, and he hasn't really recovered and probably won't recover in terms of the general classification, and he's really now looking at stage victories.
Funny, isn't it? I mean, we've talked about how hard it is to defend a title, and we saw that with Froome last year. Okay, he crashed, but why did he crash? You know, would the Froome this year have had such a silly crash and then crash again twice more? It might be like the first crash, but he didn't seem like last year. Didn't seem like the Froome of 2013. Something was eating him. Something was bothering him. Things weren't clicking for him. It was tough, I think, coming here as defending champion with that pressure.
And I think Nibali has really wanted to respond to this claim, this idea that last year was somehow a soft victory or he won by default. And you could sense that in him from the start, from the Grand Départ in Utrecht. You know, he really wanted to be able to climb in this company, keep this company of Quintana and Contador and Froome, and live up to this billing of one of the members of the Fab Four. And he just hasn't done it, has he?
Well, no, he hasn't, but to look at the people who did do a good ride today, people who stood out, Robert Hessink, who's had a really difficult time with his health problems, got a heart problem, I believe, that he's been getting over, has been kind of below par for a long time. Off the front, looking good, was joined up by Rafael Valls, and they look like a reasonably handy partnership, but Valls just couldn't come through. Guess Hessink's pace was too hot for him, and he finished fourth on the stage.
Rafa Valls, won Tour of Oman, didn't he? Is out of contract at Lamprey. They can't afford to keep him, and he is going to leave Lamprey. We don't know where he's going.
Well, his price has dripped down a little bit today, perhaps. Adam Yates, seventh on the stage. Fantastic ride by the Tour debutant. And on Bastille Day, two good French performances. Pierre Roland 8th and Tony Gallopin 9th.
And a third one, Warren Barguil.
Oh, of course.
Who had a nasty crash. As I pointed out on Twitter, this is a theme of his Grand Tour performances. The 2013 Vuelta, he crashed. He had a very bad crash, was going to abandon, then won two stages. Last year's Vuelta, in the penultimate stage of the Ancares, I think he banged his knee on his handlebars and was in a lot of pain again, was thinking about abandoning, and went on to ride a great stage and finished very high up on general classification.
Pity for him to survive all these tough stages that didn't suit him, and then first mountain stage, he falls off. That's annoying.
Daniel, didn't you talk to Marc Sergeant, Tony Gallopin's manager?
I did. Tony Gallopin was a big surprise, wasn't he? He's more of a ruler, baroudeur, and today he was more of a grandpa, wasn't he? A climber. Where did he finish, Lionel, on the stage?
He was ninth on the stage.
Ninth. Impressive. And still very much up there on general classification. He is
seventh overall.
So I spoke to his Lotto Soudal team manager, Marc Sergent, after the finish here in Pierre Saint-Martin. Today we discovered that Tony Gallopin is a general classification rider. We didn't know this before today's stage.
Well, let's say it's one stage, one mountain stage. Let's see tomorrow and after tomorrow. But judging it from today, it was very good. He said that I will go as long as I can. And we said, okay, it's going to cut your chances of winning a stage maybe, because if you're closing GC, they will not let you go. But I understand he's a French guy and he wants to see how far he can go in a tour. And be willing to see how long he can go.
You must be slightly surprised, though. I mean, we've never seen this kind of performance from Tony before, certainly on a stage as big as the Tour de France.
No, there was the finish whole category climb. You saw the damage. It was incredible. And I hope he recovers for tomorrow, because tomorrow it's maybe, in total of the race, will be harder. But the race will be more controlled by Sky because they have a big lead now. If he can hold it, good. If he drops, stage win is still possible.
I mean, Tony is still very close on general classification, but knowing what they know about his past performances, maybe Sky would let him go on a stage like tomorrow. No one expects the GC to be decided on a day like tomorrow.
True, but on the other hand, you have some other riders who want to win the stage. I think Quintana, Valverde, a lot of guys will try and do something, and they can also have the liberty of Sky. We don't know.
And just last thing, Mark, any surprises today in who we saw get dropped, the strength of Sky, the collective strength of Sky?
Yeah, I think at a certain point they gave us 50 names, and we heard four guys of Sky. And the second best team was two, and 1K further down, it was he was alone. So I think we didn't have television at the end. I think he did a great attack, and then the whole group exploded, and that was it.
Thank you.
Okay, other notable performances today. Adam Yates, now one of the Yates twins, he seems to have been finding his climbing legs. Simon Yates started well. He was eighth, I think, up the Mour de Huy after crashing also that day.
He's currently ill.
He's got a sore throat, hasn't he? I spoke to him at the start this morning. Adam Yates was a bit more chipper when I spoke to him. But, you know, he kept good company there on that stage. And for a debutant to finish seventh, you know, ahead of Pierre Roland, Tony Galopin, TJ Van Garderen, ahead of Alberto Contador, that's pretty outstanding. And I think you spoke to him at the finish, Daniel, and his DS.
I did, and you can tell from today's stage not only how gifted he is, but how ambitious he is. I saw him come in to the Orica Green Edge when he arrived at the bus this evening, got ready to do his warm-up. One of the soigneurs there congratulated
warm
him.
Down.
Sorry, warm down.
Or was he off to do?
Knows. Who knows what he was doing tonight? One of the soigneurs went to congratulate him on his performance, and he sort of shrugged and said, "Well, I still lost what have I lost 2 minutes on?" So he was pretty disappointed to have lost that much time, which is pretty extraordinary. But I spoke to him. Well, you're going to hear Matt Rendell, I think ITV's Matt Rendell, asking the questions, and Gregor Brown, good friend of the podcast. They were both asking questions to Adam Yates. Here he is, and then immediately after that, you're going to hear from Matt White, Whitey, the Orica Green Edge Direct Sportif, talking about Adam Yates' performance.
Adam, how hard was that final climb for you?
Yeah, it's pretty difficult. Lost 2 minutes. I think I sent from the stage, so yeah, for my first Tour de France, it's a pretty good result. But is it for him who won?
Yes.
Congrats to him. I think for sure, with that performance, he's by far the strongest, and well, in my opinion, he's probably going to win the Tour.
And you were up there in the group of, probably the rest of the riders who are going to constitute the upper echelons of the GC. How did that feel? What did you see?
Yeah, I mean, I was in a good position because we took it easy in TTT. So I'm a little bit fresher than some of these big GC guys. I was distanced with when the Contador was dropped. And, I was rode at my own pace, and I worked my way back up. I caught up to Galopin, and then we worked together to catch the other guys. But yeah, I think I couldn't go much harder than that. I was pretty full gas.
And for the first contact with the mountains, have you learned something there about the others and about yourself?
Oh, not really. I think it's pretty similar to every other race. It's just there's a little bit more stress coming into the bottom of the climb. There's a couple more stages. Hopefully I can get up there again and hopefully take a win.
Adam, well done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you describe that pace when Contador is dropped? It looked pretty lethal by Richie Port there.
Well, yeah, I was dropped as well, so pretty savage. I was at the back of the group when it split, and the person in front of me got dropped, but I was in no position to continue anyway. As I said a second ago, I managed to work my way back up towards the front, but yeah, it was pretty full gas.
Do you feel that you managed it well, catching Van Garderen and then leaving him behind as well?
Well, I think I know my own ability, and as soon as them guys started pushing on and it was too much for me, I just, as I said, rode at my own pace and gauged my effort. That's the max for me.
So does this give you confidence that a stage win is within reach the next couple of days or in the Alps?
I thought at the beginning of the tour, a stage win was always possible. I've shown in the past that I can climb with some of the best guys in the world when I'm on a good day. So, Tour de France is another step up. and another couple of stages that I could win, so we'll try again another day.
I know you don't want to hype these guys up too much, Adam and Simon, but it's going to be difficult after performances like that, isn't it? Hype them up too much.
No, you guys can do that.
Right.
You guys can hype them up all you want. But they're class acts, aren't they? There's no surprise. There's no surprise. But that was a very, very impressive ride for a young man.
And all chances of going in breaks, getting out of the general classification so we can have a better chance of winning the stage. I mean, that's obviously not going to happen in the immediate future, is it now?
Well, on some stages, riders don't have a choice. If you know, when it's a hilly start to the tour, Simon's carrying a little bit of an illness at the moment. He's going to be fine in a couple of days. But you know what it's like. Some days it's easy to get in the break, and some days it's harder. When it's who's the best bike rider, or who's got the best on the first climb of the day, I think these guys might have a bit of say who goes in the break.
Yeah.
Not tactics.
So it doesn't sound as though you're particularly surprised by Adam's performance, but any other surprises today and what you saw out there on the road through me putting so much time into everyone else?
No, I think the Sky quite predictable how they ride. They wanted to smash everyone straight away and they did a pretty good job at it. So they want to assert their authority. They've got the guys and the team to be able to do that. And now it's just playing catch up for everyone else, isn't it?
And your plan now, obviously a lot of support has to go behind Adam, yeah?
Look, our plan hasn't changed. We had a few changes in the first week, but our plan is still to go for stages. Adam's not here, nor Simon. They've never been here for general classification. To do anything in the young riders' jersey, they've got to beat Quintana, which means they need to finish on the podium at the Tour de France. So that ain't going to happen. So our plan hasn't changed. We're really about trying to win a stage. And we've got many, many opportunities. We told Adam today, if he's had good legs, go for it. And obviously, he had good legs. And yeah, top 10 in the stage of the Tour de France is a very, very credible result.
Okay, we heard there from Adam Yates and Matt White. You're absolutely right, Daniel, about the focus of those guys. I met them in London just before the tour, and yeah, for Adam Yates, riding his first tour, said he wasn't daunted at all. He said he never had any posters on his walls of riders, didn't look up to him. They were just, he wasn't fazed at all to be in the company of your Froomes, your Contadors, your Nibalis. Just doesn't bother him at all. He sees them as equals. And there's a famous story, of course, from last year, which I did see on the podcast last year, of a tour of Turkey, the stage where he finished second and on his way to overall victory, when on the same stage his brother Simon crashed out, broke his collarbone. The DS drove up alongside him and said, "Adam, your brother's crashed, he's broken his collarbone," to which Adam responded, "Keep your mind on the race." And I asked Adam Yates about that, and he said, "Well, yeah, of course. I mean, Simon would have done exactly the same. I mean, there's a race on. There's nothing I can do about his broken collarbone while I'm riding a race, is there?" So, you know, quite focused.
Stop off and buy him some grapes and a bottle of Lucozade and some magazines to read in hospital.
Just on a serious point about his ambition, there is a touch of the Nairo Quintanas about him, because you speak to Eusebio Unzue, the manager of Movistar, he will tell you that he's seen many climbers, or certainly a few climbers with the ability of Nairo Quintana, Colombians, but he's never seen any Colombian or indeed any other rider with Nairo Quintana's focus and ambition.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I mean, we need to get off this mountain, Jeff.
We need to get off this mountain. I was just going to say, the thing I was going to say earlier during the doping chat about exceptional performances and incredible performances, you know, in the context of tour history, winning by a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes at the top of the mountain is nothing. Some of the performances in the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, Eddie Merckx won a stage by 9 minutes, didn't he, near here?
We passed it today. We passed the finish today in Morengs.
Having been on the attack for 130 kilometres?
Something like that. And he went on to win that tour by, was it 17 or 18 minutes?
You know, those they were worried that Merckx was killing the tour, of course, at the time. But in the past, the gaps have come right down. This would have been a very close finish in those days.
Well, yeah, I mean, but the gaps have come right down because the entire machinery around the Tour de France is designed to create a close race. And so, you know, what they want is a race where the dream scenario this morning was that the four contenders had been joined by one other rider, and we had a really close Tour de France between people who, on the paper, as Chiro would say, were very evenly matched. And although those time gaps have opened up today, it's really difficult to see them close back up again.
It is, but as we saw in 2013, the tour is a tour and anything can still happen.
And just to point out, Eddie Merckx won that stage by that enormous margin. He didn't have a motorhome, and he also, I think on the run-in, they came over the Obisque, and on the run-in to Morengs, he had a bidon at least half full of champagne.
Wow, and his jersey was all baggy, and his bike was heavy.
So was everybody else's.
And very final thing, we mentioned Chiro. Mark Cavendish, I know for a fact, was very tickled by the video of Chiro running away from our perch where we were doing the podcast the other day. He thought it was hilarious.
Great, thanks for that. Okay, well, let's wrap up there. We'll be back tomorrow for more. Kilometre Zero this morning was behind the scenes with the mechanics. That you'll find that in usual places, Kilometre Zero. Kilometre Zero tomorrow, Lionel, is?
It's Daniel's piece on crashes.
Essential listening. Well, lots of good stuff in there. A reminder that our exclusive interview with Dave Brailsford and Chris Froome is available to friends of the podcast. Sign up for £5 at thiscyclingpodcast.com. That was Friday evening we spent with Froome and Brailsford, and very interesting, especially in light of what's happened since, I think. So sign up there. Finally, tonight, a reminder that Wednesday evening, that's tomorrow, is our second live podcast from the Tour de France. That will be broadcast or podcast at 6 p.m. UK time, 7 p.m. French time. And that'll be myself, Lionel, Daniel, perhaps Ciro Scogni Emilio as well, if we can entice him to join us, broadcasting live from the Tour de France. Send your questions to us at cycling_podcast on Twitter with the hashtag CPLive. That's hashtag CPLive. We look forward to getting your questions and answering them in our podcast. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
For the best analysis, discussions and interviews from the 2015 Tour de France, listen to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.